Before we jump into this interview, I wanted to make mention of the fact that the interview that we're presenting is designed to provide accurate and helpful information regarding whatever the subject matter is that's being covered. But we're making this available with the understanding that we're not endeavoring to be offering specific legal, accounting, medical, financial, psychological, or other professional services. Laws and regulations are continually changing, and they can vary according to location and time. So we're just not wanting to make any kind of representation that the information here that we're offering is applicable for all locations and times. And if you need legal advice, medical advice, psychological advice, accounting advice, or whatever, obviously we want you to seek out the services of competent professionals in the area of need. But we hope this is very helpful to you, and we wish you the very best as you listen. God bless you. This is Tony Cook, and I'm so glad you've joined us for this interview. Sitting across from me in the studio today is Dr. Bill Bucher. And I'm going to be talking with Bill today about managing marital differences. Bill is a professional licensed marriage and family therapist, and I didn't really get to know Bill on a professional level. I got to know Bill from tennis. We both belong to the same tennis club and just happened to connect, and we've hit quite regularly, played a lot of tennis together and really enjoyed it. And Bill, thanks for coming in today and talking to the listeners. And sure. Tell us about your background, where you're from and your schooling, your why you got interested in becoming a counselor, and also your teaching, you know, aspects. Just give us the rundown of who you are.
Sure. Thanks, Tony, for inviting me to be part of this conversation today. I am actually a fourth-generation son of Pentecostal preachers, growing up in New England, in New Hampshire, to be exact. Mm-hmm. Came out to Oral Roberts University years ago to play baseball, actually, back in the late 70s.
Catcher.
Yeah, took all the beating. And did my undergraduate work there as well. Went on to get a Master of Divinity degree there, as well as a Doctor of Ministry and a Master's in Counseling, and then ended up doing my PhD work at Oklahoma State University. Mm-hmm. And in the process, was in pastoral ministry for a while. With my wife, Kim. I have two daughters, Megan and Rachel, who are 18 and 11. Mm-hmm. And I teach now full-time at Oral Roberts University in their Master's in Counseling program.
What are some of the courses you teach?
Yeah, I teach marriage counseling, family therapy, courses in ethics and professional issues, in spiritual development, religion and personality. I could several others as well, but just really interesting courses to teach. And plus, I get to practice what I teach. So I maintain a private practice in the community as well in the area of marriage and family therapy. So I get to go back and forth between both offices. So what sounds mm-hmm. good in the classroom, I get to actually implement in the counseling office. And
that's really excellent, because otherwise things can get pretty theoretical.
That's right.
You're continually reminded of the nitty-gritty where the rubber meets the road.
That's right. Things that sound so well in the classroom don't always apply so easily in the office. And so that keeps me humble and mm-hmm. and helps me to hopefully express to the students the challenges that they'll face as they go out themselves to become their own professionals in the field.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, the time that I especially got interested in doing this interview with you was a few weeks ago, and we had just finished playing. We were both, you know, well, you're in better shape than I am, but I was out of breath. But I just mentioned that my wife and I were that weekend going to be traveling out and doing a marriage conference, which we don't do very many of those, but we do them once in a while. And I just thought, hey, you know, we're right here, and let me just ask you a quick question. I asked you, what's the number one thing that you see in your practice? And if I remember right, and correct me and add to this or clarify it, but you said something, and it really caught my attention. You said that one of the major keys to successful marriages is when couples have learned to, did you say, manage their differences?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you shared some great things, and share some of that with our listeners today.
Sure. I think at at all levels of society, really, from the political and the religious on down to the grassroots of marriage, this challenge of managing differences is really critical. And we've learned several things about it. There's been some really creative research in the field of marriage therapy over the last few years. A man by the name of Dr. John Gottman out of the University of Washington has spearheaded much of it. And out of his research and others who have collaborated with him, we've learned about this whole area of differences and how in a relationship, if you took your average marriage couple and were able to follow them over the course of their married life, and you looked at all the differences that would emerge between them, just by virtue of their different personalities and different orientations to life and their uniqueness and so forth. And if you could place all of their differences into one of two categories, one category being those differences that are resolvable. In other words, these are the differences they'll be able to work through, negotiate, and get on the same page about, kind of find agreement about, versus those differences that will be perpetual in their relationship. In other words, they can learn to make adjustments and accommodate to each other, but in spite of their best efforts, there'll still be some measure of difference between them on this particular issue. Mm-hmm. What percentage would you guess would fall into each category?
Oh, mercy. I'll throw out 50-50. I have no clue.
Sure.
I'm just totally guessing.
Yeah, and what we found is that about 69% of differences fall into this perpetual category as opposed to resolvable.
Wait a minute. You're saying that 69% of the issues overall in marriage, that the couple, they're always going to have a difference in that area.
Yes.
That's huge. They better know how to manage the differences.
That's true. And let me give you some examples of common ones. You kind of get a sense of why this is. Take, for instance, the area of neatness and organization. Mm-hmm. So one spouse, maybe you're really your tidy, neat person. The other one's a little sloppy, you know. Mm-hmm. The sloppy one can learn to become a little more neat. The neat one can learn to become a little more relaxed. But chances are, in spite of their accommodations, there'll still be some measure of difference that'll show up over and over again in their relationship in that area. Other common areas would be things like punctuality. You know, one person's always on time, if not early, to everything. Mm-hmm. The other one's always, you know, 5 minutes late. All the way to areas of finances, one person wanting to save for the future, the other person wanting to spend now. Differences in sexual desire, that is a common one. Differences in together time versus separate time. One person wanting much more together time, the person more space to do his or her own thing. Differences in how to discipline the kids, and on it goes. So all of these areas that really reflect differences in personality and temperament, orientation to life, have a way of showing up over and over again in the relationship. And what we've learned is that the key area regarding those differences is not necessarily to resolve them, in other words, to make the couple somehow alike in that area, but to really teach them how to manage the difference. The trap that we tend to fall into as couples is that when we encounter these kinds of differences, our first instinct is to often try to change our partner. And so couples fall into this trap of trying to resolve the difference between them by changing the other. And, of course, as soon as that happens, they tend to get into what we call gridlock over their differences, each of them trying to change the other, both of them digging their heels in, getting a little resistant to change. Because as soon as you get the sense that my partner is trying to change me, then it feels as if my partner's love has become conditional. It's as if our partner is saying, well, I'll love you if. And part of what we're thinking, well, is, you know, if you really love me, you would just accept me as I am. Of course, the other partner's thinking, if you really loved me, you know how important this is for me that you change, and so you just change for me. But, of course, you know, when we're trying to change the other, we're essentially trying to control something we can't control, which is another person, which leads to increasing frustration, the gridlock that couples get into. And by the time they end up in my office for marriage therapy, the gridlock can be pretty profound, and sometimes finding ways to break through that gridlock is the challenge of therapy, to see if I can't get them to find a different way of addressing and talking about their differences.
You used a term on the tennis court, and I went out to the car and wrote it down because I didn't want to forget it. You said that the couples who did well, and you mentioned the man having a real key part in this, and not trying to put 100% of the responsibility there. We know it's a shared relationship, but she said the man was very vital in this, and that the couples that did well were where the man learned to receive influence.
Yes.
And share power.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that? I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, this was a hypothesis that the researcher I mentioned previously, John Gottman, came up with, and it has received a lot of support in the research and in the various findings. And his hypothesis was essentially this, that marriages will work to the extent that husbands accept influence from and share power with their wives. It didn't work in reverse, because what he discovered was that wives were already doing this at a high rate. They were already accepting influence.
So wives, you're saying women are more hardwired that direction, and
yeah,
men
either
are
hardwired
not so much.
Or just socialized that way. I'm not sure if or some combination of it, because it seems like in our society, and there's been researchers who've looked at this in different ways, but Deborah Tannen and some of her work and others have seen men as more socialized to compete, women more socialized to connect. So when you have women who are talking with each other, they're often looking for what they have in common.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see women as they talk say things like, oh, you too? Well, so do I. And so they find that common area, they connect around it. Whereas men, when they talk, they're often looking for what distinguishes me from you, what mm-hmm. sets me apart, who's on top, who's better than.
Mm-hmm.
And so the competition, the one-upping of each other and so forth. So when a man comes into a relationship with a woman now, and he's socialized to compete and sensitive to those dynamics, he tends to frame things in win-lose terms.
Mm-hmm.
So when the wife comes along and she's trying to have an influence, and by that I mean she's maybe comes along and she has an idea. She makes a suggestion. She has something she wants, let's say, and she makes a request. Well, if it's something that the husband doesn't necessarily agree with or want to do and so forth, since he's socialized to compete and he's thinking in win-lose terms, well, his first instinct is to shut her down,
mm-hmm.
which one of the most common complaints we have from wives is that they don't have a voice in their relationship. To them, it feels as if my voice doesn't get heard, that when I speak up, it's like he doesn't really listen. He doesn't really take what I have to say into consideration. And as a result, women often feel like they have to become increasingly manipulative to have an influence in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Is this, Bill, kind of going back to the old macho thing with guys?
I think so. Yes, and I think it's for some of them, it's sort of an extreme version of the headship model, where the guy thinks that, okay, I get to make the call in the relationship. I get to be the decision maker ultimately and so forth, to the extent where he assumes or takes power unto himself and is often feels threatened to share it.
Mm-hmm.
Often reflects an insecurity sometimes on the part of the husband. And what husbands really need to learn many times in relationships is sort of the paradox of it all, in that in relationships, you really win by losing,
mm-hmm.
If you can really call it losing, in a sense, the idea being that if you accept influence from your wife, and by accepting influence, that doesn't mean that, you know, the wife gets everything she wants and every time she has a request, it automatically gets granted. But rather, it means that there's this give and take. There's this willingness to hear what she's saying, to enter into a conversation and even negotiation with her, so that it becomes more of a partnership where we're talking together and deciding jointly as to what we're going to do. And this accepting of influence sends a very important message to the wife, the message being that you're important to me, that when you mm-hmm. speak, I listen, I value what you have to say, so much so that I'm willing to take into consideration some of your ideas, even when I may not necessarily agree with them myself or even like them.
Mm-hmm.
But because I love you and I value you, I'm willing to listen and to work with you. And because the wife feels so valued by that, then obviously her ability to respond to him is greatly enhanced, and he ends up winning because of the quality of relationship that ensues from his ability to accept influence.
Mm-hmm.
So for husbands, it has a lot to do sometimes with recognizing that what may work for them in other arenas, like the business arena, where maybe a more competitive mindset works well, does not necessarily translate well into the home.
Mm-hmm.
That in the home, a different mindset is often important, one that involves more of the ability to work with another, to share power with another, to accept influence from another, and to recognize that the value of that in essentially creating win-win kind of situations.
I know when my wife and I got married, we were married in 1979, and I was one of four brothers. And so I was raised kind of in a total athletic, competitive environment. And I know the first few years of our marriage, I really did have a mindset that if Lisa would just think like I thought, if she would just see this situation the way I see it. Mm-hmm. And I really did. I mean, I wasn't trying to be mean. I wasn't trying to be overbearing. But everything was there was an underlying, I'm always trying to persuade her to, you know, conform to the way I see things. Is that pretty prevalent in marriage?
I think so. I think it takes, in general terms, it takes husbands a little bit longer to catch on.
I was very dense. It took me a while.
Yeah, most guys are not socialized well to do the relational thing, mm-hmm. essentially. Whereas females quite often are. They seem to be ahead of the game compared to most guys, which is why the research is showing us that much of the challenge of marriage really falls on the shoulders of husbands who really need to step up and be willing to allow the relationship of marriage to change them as opposed to them trying to change, you know, their spouse. I joke with my students, although it's really I'm really not joking when I say that I think marriage is one of God's favorite tools for growing us up.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, marriage wasn't necessarily designed to make us happy. It was designed to grow us up. But for those who allow it to grow them up, it does make them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this especially applies to men who are often challenged to make some very important changes in the way that they relate to others, beginning, of course, with their wife and then, you know, children and others. Because we're unfortunately not always trained or socialized to be good partners in marriage. We kind of learn that on into the process, and hopefully before we've done too much damage. You know?
Exactly. Bill, what do you say when you have a couple in your office, and maybe you've actually had this happen, I don't know, but just a hypothetical situation. You're trying to communicate to a man, a husband, that he needs to receive influence from his wife and that he needs to share power with her.
Mm-hmm.
And he does the, you know, fist on the table, bless God, I'm the head of this house.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible says I'm the head and she's supposed to submit to me. You know, and he's convinced he's got the Bible on his side.
Sure.
And here you are offering this non-biblical, he thinks, humanistic advice.
Yeah.
What do you do with that?
Well, knowing that he does respect Scripture in terms of what Scripture says, then I would sometimes challenge his understanding of Scripture or maybe try to expand his understanding of Scripture when he refers to that famous passage in Ephesians 5, you know, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands. Then I would certainly encourage him to read on where the next verse says, and husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, and would challenge him to think in terms of how Christ loved the church.
Mm-hmm.
And if we thought in terms of what that love was like, the characteristics and qualities of it, I think we would find it to be a very servant-oriented kind of love.
Mm-hmm.
So that husbands who are loving their wives as Christ loved the church are really, in a sense, almost turning the paradigm on its head, where instead of wives submitting to the husbands are essentially submitting to the wives, in a sense, in terms of this servant-oriented coming underneath her, so to speak, to empower her to become all she can be.
And that whole passage of Scripture actually begins, I think Ephesians 5:21 says,
right,
submitting yourselves one to another,
right,
in the fear of God. It's not
absolutely
an entirely male dominant type thing. And I'll tell you one thing that was an eye-opener for me is when I saw that headship, when it's the Bible says Christ is the head of the church, that really I don't think began with authority. I think that began with responsibility. It was responsibilities that were carried out by Jesus toward the church. As you indicated a few moments ago, the way he loved the church, the way he served the church, he washed the feet of the disciples. The Bible says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it.
Yes.
And so that's all responsibility. That's not even – I know Christ has authority in the church as well. But he really focused on his responsibility when he was here on the earth.
Absolutely. And I'm always struck as well by the similarity between Paul's charge to the husbands to love their wives as Christ loved the church and Jesus' own admonition to his disciples. Actually, it was in his last conversation with his disciples before the cross, and John's gospel records it in quite a bit of detail. Jesus gives them a new commandment, you remember. He washes their feet again, you know, a very descriptive way of how he loved the church. And then he goes on to say, and a new commandment I give to you, love one another as I've loved you. By this shall all know that you're my disciples, by the way you love each other. I used to think that that commandment was just, you know, another way of saying the, you know, love your neighbor commandment. Until I looked a little closer and thought, you know, there's really something distinctive about this that goes beyond the first two that Jesus already gave us. You know, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, body, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And now this new commandment, he says in the final conversation, love each other, love one another. And I realize it's new for a couple of reasons. One, in terms of the object, one another. The first commandment, the object was God, love God. The second commandment was love your neighbor, which when asked who is my neighbor, Jesus responds with the parable of the Good Samaritan, you remember. The neighbor being really anyone that we meet, even the stranger. And then this last commandment, love one another. And he seems to be focusing to those closest to you, those part of the household of faith and so forth. And then the standard by which we're to love one another. Of course, in the first commandment, the first and great commandment, the standard by which we love God is with all our heart, soul, mind, body, and strength. The standard by which we love the neighbor is as we love ourselves. And now in this new commandment, the standard by which we love each other is as Christ loved us. And it sounds so similar to me in comparison with what Paul is saying to husbands. You know, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Jesus is saying, love one another as I've loved you. And to me, that this there's a special love that's to be exhibited to those closest to us. And that this love is to be a witness to those around us. Jesus said, by this shall all know that you're my disciples, by the way you love each other. And I think Paul is suggesting that Christian marriage here should be a picture to those around of Christ's love for the church and Christ's relationship to the church. In fact, the Catholic Church even makes marriage a sacrament for that very reason, that it's an outward sign of an inward grace. And so I think that there's a sense in which in Christian marriage, certainly, this special love is to be exhibited. Although I'll acknowledge that sometimes loving those closest to us is the hardest of all.
Yeah.
You know, it's easier to love the stranger that you can love and leave
as
compared to loving those you got to do life with, you know, 24/7.
Superficial relationships never put us in that incubator of spiritual growth because it wouldn't be superficial. But I liked what you said about marriage being the pathway to, I don't remember your term, spiritual maturity, spiritual growth. But it really does. It gives us the opportunity to either bring out the best in us or to bring out the worst, one
Absolutely.
Or the other.
I mean, there's nothing like trying to love your partner in marriage that sooner or later is going to expose all of my own growth areas. You know, when you're trying to relate intimately to someone, you're trying to do life together, sooner or later, the challenges of that just expose my own growth areas. Unfortunately, what often happens when our own growth areas get exposed, and it's usually because of some, you know, difference that's emerged between us that we're trying to manage, our temptation is to focus on our partner, and we tend to be very aware in those moments of all the ways in which we wish our partner were different. And so our first instinct, again, is to try to change him or her to make them more like we want them to be. But when that becomes our approach, we miss out on the opportunities for personal growth that are there for us. Because even if we're right and our partner does need to change in some ways, we can't make that happen. We can't control that piece. So the challenge is to bring the focus back to ourselves and to say, okay, how can I work on me in the context of my relationship with my partner so that I can take an honest look at what's being revealed about me in this situation that I do have some control over, and how do I work on me and thus experience growth in this area, knowing that as I change, it will influence my partner, because in relationships we're so interconnected that when one person changes or makes adjustments, it automatically influences the other. So how can I work on me in the context of my relationship with my partner and stay focused on the aspect of all of this that I have some control over, and in so doing use this as a path to growth for myself?
Couples that come into your office, Bill, how many of them are coming in with an agenda, I want you to fix my spouse?
Well, unfortunately, that's not uncommon. Again, what spouses tend to be the most aware of is how their partner needs to change. And quite often they're coming in and often wanting me to play the role of judge and jury to say, you know, you're right, you're guilty, and so forth. But part of my challenge is to help each of them become more aware of how they're both contributing to the problem that they've identified, that this problem just is hardly ever just the fault of one. You know, both have found ways to contribute to this, and to get them each to accept some responsibility for it.
Okay. Let's just throw out a scenario if we can. Husband and wife come in. Let's pick one of the areas you said that are, I guess, maybe in the somewhat unresolvable, that people can make some adjustments, but their hardwiring won't necessarily change. Let's just do the punctuality issue. Tell us how you might work that couple through that and come to terms with the fact that maybe this person is never going to totally change.
Yeah, I would, again, begin by acknowledging for each of them, or just really affirming, I guess, for them, how annoying some of these differences can be. I mean, it can be frustrating when one person is very time conscious and they're very aware that we're running a little late to make our appointment.
Some people can get in a panic about that all the time.
Sure. Yeah. And when they see their partner kind of dragging, you know, their feet, and whether it's intentionally or not intentionally and so forth, it gets annoying. It gets irritating. So I start by just affirming that, that these perpetual differences can be very aggravating in a relationship. And I try to help them recognize that the difference is just that. It's a difference. It's not a right or wrong thing. Because quite often couples will want to frame their difference in terms of right and wrong. They'll think in terms of categories. So one of the things we have to get out of is this categorical thinking where things are put into either-or boxes. You know, it's black or white, it's right or wrong, it's either-or. In these cases, we're talking about differences. Differences, again, that are due to other factors like, you know, personality and socialization and so forth. So I begin by affirming how annoying the differences can be. I try to help them to accept them as differences. And then we talk about the importance of focusing on the aspects of this that they have control over versus the aspects they don't have control over. Sometimes it's sort of as basic as that old serenity prayer. You know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So in this case, we talk about, all right, what do you actually have control over in this situation? And are you focused on what you can control, or are you focused on what you can't control, and as a result, you're trying to change something or someone that you really can't control, which is often the trap they've fallen into. They're trying to change each other. So I talked to them about a concept called radical acceptance, which is designed to get them out of this control mode. Okay, so we talk about radical acceptance being essentially this idea that, you know, it is what it is. Your partner is who he or she is. You don't have to like it all the time. You know, it may be annoying. Some of it may be annoying to you, but it is what it is. So if we can find that place of radical acceptance as a place to begin, it doesn't mean that we want it to stay this way all the time, but at least for now we're going to accept that this is our reality. This is our experience. It is what it is. So in finding that place of radical acceptance, we're trying to move from control to what I call curiosity, and then ultimately to creativity. So to
say those again, please, those steps.
From control to curiosity to creativity.
Okay.
So to get out of the control trap, we do the radical acceptance thing. it is what it is, he or she is who he or she is, kind of thing, even though I may not always like it or I may wish it were different, but, you know, it is what it is.
It sounds like it's kind of a letting go of control.
Exactly. Okay. That's exactly what it's designed to do, to help us avoid that control trap where we're trying to control things we ultimately can't or control people we ultimately can't mm-hmm. control. So in finding that place of radical acceptance, then we can move into what I call this place of curiosity, being able to say, all right, what do we have here? You know, what is this difference all about? What do we have to work with? What's sort of the raw material here of our experience that we're going to have to manage somehow? Mm-hmm. So the curiosity is designed to just essentially explore the difference. Where does this difference come from? Why does it exist? What is it about? And so forth. And then in understanding the difference, moving into creativity, which has to do with how we're going to manage this difference, mm-hmm. Where we learned that managing difference has more to do with managing myself than mm-hmm. managing my partner. So this is where couples hopefully find a place where they can begin to work more collaboratively, more cooperatively to manage a difference that they've learned has become, you know, fairly annoying in their relationship from time mm-hmm. to time. But in a collaborative, you know, creative way, learning how to manage it. And this is where humor can often go a long way as mm-hmm. they learn to laugh at each other, accept each other. You'll see couples who've been married a long time who are have very good marriages and they'll just kind of give you that wry grin sometimes and say, that's just the way he is or that's mm-hmm. just who she is. They've learned how to manage that mm-hmm. and not take things too personally and get too reactive to it and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the approaches that we'll take is just – and then helping them to realize how it's really in their best interest to use these challenges that come in the form of differences as really opportunities to work on themselves in the context of their relationship because it's conducive to their own growth. Mm-hmm. If they're trying to change their partner, then they're not growing. You know, their partner might if they're successful, I suppose. But, you know, they're not going to grow because they're demanding that other people change, but not them. Mm-hmm. So for relationships to grow and for us to grow in relationships, we have to be willing to work on ourselves mm-hmm. In that process.
Now, what do you do? You mentioned a moment ago about the long-tenured married couple. Mm-hmm. And they have that sense of humor about it. They've accepted it. Mm-hmm. They've long ago given up any aspiration of changing the person in that area. Mm-hmm. And they have the attitude. That's just the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when it's the other way around? What happens when it's the person who should make some changes, should make some concessions, should try to do a little bit better, either, you know, the person who's always late, you know, trying to be a little bit better time-wise, or the person who's always in a panic because, you know, trying to chill out a little bit.
Sure.
What happens when they refuse to change and they use what you're talking about as basically a cop-out
mm-hmm.
and say, well, that's just the way I am, and it's almost a passive-aggressive thing
mm-hmm.
of, you know, I'm not going to give you anything in this area.
Sure. Yeah, when that happens, you have a different dynamic in place because you don't have necessarily the sincere, good faith, collaborative kind of effort. You have one person digging in his or her heels and pretty much demanding that the other person accept them as they are, mm-hmm. which then, as you say, lets them off the hook so they don't have to change. Well, that leaves the other spouse who is motivated to make some changes with something of a challenge or a dilemma because they can either just accept their spouse completely as, you know, he or she is, and that's, you know, part of it. But if this change has become irritating to the point where it's causing a real problem in the relationship and the other spouse is really unwilling to change, then maybe the other spouse has, again, keeping the focus on him or herself, on what they can control. So let's say, going back to this example of punctuality, so let's say the spouse who's always running late is the one who's sort of dug in his or her heel and say, okay, I'm not going to change. You have to accept me. This is just the way I am. I'm just this way kind of thing. Then the other spouse may have to decide, all right, you know, am I going to just constantly allow myself to be irritated by this situation. So every time we're going to an appointment or we have to go somewhere, I'm always running into this panic because I realize we're late and I'm getting irritated. And by the time we get to where we're going, we're in a bad mood, all that sort of thing. So let's say it's the wife who is the one who's always running late. And so the husband may think to himself, okay, I can either just choose to do what she's asking and just accept her for the way she is and just be somehow content with always showing up 5 minutes late everywhere we go. Or I can decide if she's not going to change, then, well, maybe I will. Mm-hmm. So I may just go ahead and leave. And if she's not ready on time, then I'll say, well, I'll meet you there, hon. I'm on my way. She may not like that, and it may seem she may call me, you know, rude and insensitive and so forth. But essentially, I'm focusing on what I can control. So instead of just ending up in a bad mood, irritated and so forth, I'll show up. I'll be on time. Let's say it's a church service we're going to. We're always late for Sunday morning church service and so forth. Well, I go ahead and decide I'm going to go on time. I'll see you there, hon. And then she'll just have to get there when she gets there, and maybe we'll both work it out that way. But what often happens, and this is where, again, it goes back to focusing on what you can control. Because we're so interconnected in relationships, constantly playing off of each other in relationships, that when one person does decide to make a change, it really does influence the other one way or another. Mm-hmm. Now, the wife, you know, again, she may say, I'm not going to change. She may really be resistant to changing. But after her husband has sort of left her to go to church by himself and she's come in late, she may decide after a while that, well, you know, I'm going to get ready on time and go with him next time. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, if there are extenuating circumstances, if there are children involved and the wife's trying to get children ready and so forth, that's a whole different story. That's where the husband needs to be helping her or she helping the husband. I don't want to sound too stereotypical with my mm-hmm. roles here, but the idea being that they need to be working together to make sure that the kids get ready and everybody gets ready and so forth. So sometimes there are extenuating circumstances as to why someone's always running late. Those certainly have to be factored mm-hmm. in. But if it's this passive aggressive thing that you described earlier, where one of them really just is almost seemingly doing it intentionally, just to
tick the other person off.
Yeah. That what one theorist called normal marital sadism, in the sense that we do things intentionally to irritate the other. If it's that kind of scenario, then that's what I'm suggesting, that the other spouse may have to still focus on what he or she can control and decide, all right, how am I going to manage me? What am I going to do to avoid just becoming a victim of this situation mm-hmm. every time it occurs? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that may involve, as I suggested, even some unusual kind of behaviors. But they're designed, again, to help the spouse manage him or herself as opposed to, once again, going through that same here-we-go-again scenario where they feel like mm-hmm. I get victimized every time something like this occurs.
So the third stage you talked about was the creative stage, right?
Yeah.
And so one creative option would be to, you know, the guy take off and she just comes when she can come and all mm-hmm. that. Another option they could come up with there would be to the guy just always tells her he wants to leave 10 minutes before he really wants to
there
leave
you go. That's
and
another
builds
one.
In a buffer.
Sure.
You know, on the leaving, and I've heard of couples doing that, you know, in some cases, to bring in a business thought, what is it called, a cost-risk analysis,
mm-hmm.
You know, or cost-benefit, whatever the term is, where you ask what is the benefit of this versus the cost.
Right.
And he may find out that by leaving his wife and making her drive separately, there's not as much benefit as what mm-hmm. there is cost if that's going to give her angst.
That's right.
After
so,
the fact.
Yeah. And so in attempting that particular strategy, he may decide after all that it's in his best interest to go ahead and accept her as she is and just be patient and wait the extra 5 minutes for her to get ready because mm-hmm. it's not worth it to mm-hmm. to be on time. So you're absolutely right. There's always that cost-benefit analysis that we do where we realize that maybe something wasn't as irritating as we thought, because when we tried something different to fix it, that ended up being worse.
Mm-hmm.
So you stay flexible, you stay creative with the process, but ultimately it's this idea of acceptance, and it really leads to what we call the great marital paradox, which has been an interesting finding in the research. The great marital paradox is essentially that in marriage, people don't change unless they don't have to.
Say that again.
That in marriage, people don't change unless they don't have to.
Okay.
That change occurs best in an environment of acceptance.
Okay.
So it goes back to what we've been discussing already, that essentially when a person is feeling pressured to change, they instinctively resist it. It's like we all want to be accepted for who we are.
Or change.
Unconditionally.
Or do the change and then resent it later.
Yes. So even if they make the change or the other spouse seems to succeed in persuading the other one to change, there usually are consequences. There's some resentment quite often that goes with that, that shows up sooner or later in the relationship, where the person feels like, yes, I gave in to you, and it leads to often a keeping of score in a relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, I changed that time, I gave in this time, I sacrificed this time, now it's your turn kind of thing. But I think the idea is that acceptance really goes a long way to actually allowing us to manage our differences well mm-hmm. in relationships. And the good news is that acceptance is something we can control. Mm-hmm. I can't always control whether my spouse changes in ways that I might want her to change. But I can control whether I choose to accept the situation and her for who she is. And paradoxically, when I can find that place of acceptance, it actually increases the chances that change will occur. Mm-hmm. Because, as I suggested earlier, that whenever we get to the place of trying to change the other, it really starts to feel as if love becomes conditional.
Mm-hmm.
And we all desire, I think, to be loved unconditionally, to be accepted fully for who we are. But at the same time, we all want to become desirable to our spouse. And mm-hmm. so that's where the change process, I think, comes in. But it works better when the change is offered more as a gift as opposed to be something that seems to be demanded
okay.
from the other.
Is there a way, because I think what happens, and maybe you can give us some insight on what are the ways that people try to change their spouse. I mean, I know in marriages a lot of times people feel like the other person is always trying to manipulate me.
Mm-hmm.
What are the unhealthy ways that people try to change the other person?
Yeah, it occurs from the more overt to covert ways mm-hmm. In a relationship. Overtly, the most common form comes in the form of criticism. Mm-hmm. Where they'll become critical of the other, somehow thinking that if we point out certain faults or shortcomings or what we perceive to be needed changes, that mm-hmm. our other spouse will automatically want to do those things mm-hmm. For us. But what we know is that criticism only invites defensiveness.
Okay.
Because criticism comes across as an attack,
mm-hmm.
As though you're suggesting that this problem you've identified is due to some defect in me, that I need mm-hmm. to fix myself and then I'll be acceptable and everything will be fine. In fact, there's a very common pattern in marriage relationships. The researcher who talked about this pattern named it the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. because it's a common pattern, but what we've learned is that if this pattern isn't managed well, it can be a sign of the end mm-hmm. in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And the pattern consists of four components, the first being criticism,
mm-hmm.
where an issue has surfaced, and often it's in relation to one of those perpetual issues. Let's say that the wife is very neat and organized, the husband, you know, a little sloppy and disorganized in his own life, and she's asked him dozens of times to pick up after himself, pick his clothes up off the floor when he's snacking in the living room, to put his dishes back and so forth. Well, one more time she goes to the living room and there's his dishes on the couch where he left them after he was snacking, didn't put them back. And in frustration, she calls attention to it. But because she's frustrated, it tends to come out fairly harshly mm-hmm. in the form of a criticism. Well, because he's now feeling attacked, as she says to him, "How many times have I asked you to pick up after yourself? Don't you care about me? Don't you ever listen to me? What's wrong with you?" So now, because he's feeling attacked, he responds defensively
mm-hmm.
and says something like, "Well, I was going to get to it. I do too care about you. You know, I just was busy. I just forgot," and makes excuses and so forth. Well, because he's being defensive, she feels like, "You're not hearing me. You haven't taken me seriously." And so she ups the ante, and, you know, here we go again. She's going to try to mm-hmm. say it a little harder, a little louder, a little more forcefully. he gets a little more defensive. And so we have this criticism-defensiveness dance that starts to unfold. Well, sometimes that will escalate to the third horseman showing up, which is really the most toxic of all four. It's contempt. Contempt is anything that one spouse does to essentially put down the other, where the other is made to feel inferior in some way. It can come in the form of name-calling. It can come in the form of just a facial expression, kind of a rolling of the eyes in a dismissive kind of way, as though, you know, who are you? Why should I listen to you? And sort of thing. But contempt is really toxic for love. It kills good feelings in a relationship because the other feels so put down, so inferior, while the other one's putting himself or herself in this, you know, kind of self-righteous position. So sometimes contempt shows up. Contempt doesn't show up very much in good marriages, but it's probably, out of all the four horsemen, it's probably the one biggest predictor of divorce that we've come across, when there's a lot of contempt, because it essentially constitutes emotional abuse in a relationship. But you have this cycle, this pattern of criticism, defensiveness, sometimes contempt showing up. And, of course, while those things are unfolding, physiologically, there's an escalation occurring. The heart's starting to beat faster. We're starting to secrete adrenaline in our system. We get into that fight-or-flight mode, so to speak. And as the physiology escalates, then sometimes the fourth horseman shows up, which is quite often a guy thing to do. Most husbands are guilty of this. And that one is stonewalling. That's essentially an extreme attempt to manage myself. It's almost like the husband is feeling like, I'm about to lose it, or I'm about to explode. I can't take this anymore. So an extreme attempt to manage himself, he just shuts down.
And it's withdrawal.
Yeah.
Is this what Gray and Marr's book called going into the cave?
It's a form of that, except this one occurs just in the context of these kind of arguments where the shutdown, he may not actually leave. He may actually stay in the same room or the same vicinity as the spouse, but essentially becomes non-responsive to her. She's still talking to him. She's still trying to engage him in a conversation, and he's just not saying anything anymore. He's just shut down, not even hardly looking at her. And, of course, while this is an extreme way for him to manage his own emotions, so to speak, so he doesn't explode and do something he'll regret, it really infuriates the wife because now she's lost him completely. You know, now he's just totally disengaged, and she worries that we'll never get back to this issue. We'll never be able to talk about it. We'll never resolve it. Now you've totally shut me out. And so that what I call that dance of the horsemen, those four things, they're a common pattern in all relationships to some extent, especially the criticism, defensiveness, and sometimes stonewalling. Not so much the contempt. But when contempt shows up, that's an especially bad sign.
Do you think, Bill, can I interject a question here? Do you think there are couples that have had that wall for decades?
Yes. There are couples who, I think, out of frustration, they just don't really know how to handle things any longer. There are couples who've had differences in their relationship over the years that they've tried their best to manage and have gotten so frustrated to the point of feeling kind of helpless and hopeless about it. They don't know what to do anymore. So the wall just kind of goes up. They become increasingly disconnected and distant from each other.
Like two basically single people living in the same house.
Yeah, like roommates under the same roof, essentially. And a lot of it is just because they really don't know what to do. They've done everything they know to do, and they've run out of options.
And that's very different. That's a very different scenario from the couple that you described who had come to the radical acceptance and even had a sense of playful humor about it. There was still respect. There was still love. They just knew that this was an area that they're just wired different, and they'd learn to live graciously with it.
Because typically over the course of the years, as couples have tried to manage their differences and have gotten so possibly frustrated about it, ended up, you know, with that wall and that distance between them, chances are that many times in the course of trying to deal with the differences, especially when criticism and contempt would show up around them, that there were wounds created, things were said or done that were deeply hurtful. And they never have been able to repair or heal fully from those wounds. And so they don't even necessarily feel all that safe with each other anymore. So mm-hmm. they rarely become vulnerable to the other person anymore because they don't feel safe. If they are still together, it's a very distant relationship. Maybe they're together for other reasons, children, finances, or whatever, but not because they really have a meaningful connection with each mm-hmm. other any longer. Mm-hmm. And so part of what we're hopeful to do in my field of marriage counseling is to help couples become more aware of some of these warning signs so that they'll be able to recognize them for what they are and actually reach out and get help sooner as opposed mm-hmm. to later. Because we struggle with what we call the delay effect, which is the time between a problem first surfacing in a marriage and the couple recognizing it as being a problem until the time they actually get help for that mm-hmm. problem. It's similar to what, you know, the dilemma we had in public health some years ago around heart attacks, where there was this delay effect. The person would be having symptoms of a heart attack but not really know what that was, and so they'd ignore it or not mm-hmm. get help until it was too late, until mm-hmm. they finally would show up, you know, and it would be too late. So the public health, the American Heart Association, and so forth did a great job of educating the public about the signs of an impending heart attack. Mm-hmm. So we all know about, you know, the chest pain, shortness of breath, angina, all that sort of stuff. So that when a person starts to get those symptoms, they immediately know, ooh, could be a heart attack. They go and get help, and it's saved a lot of lives. Mm-hmm. Well, we're trying to do this in marriage to help couples recognize the signs of an ailing marriage so they'll get help. Because right now, according to one of the latest studies, the average delay effect in marriage between the time, again, that a problem surfaces and the couple gets help is 6 years.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
So by the time they show up in my office, the average couple has been dealing with this problem 6 years.
Okay.
So a lot of water's under the bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot of painful, hurtful, wounding things mm-hmm. have probably occurred. And so, you know, the healing process is pretty challenging.
Can I ask you if this pattern is prevalent? I don't want to broad brush it as though it's absolute because I know it's not. But when I was involved in pastoral ministry and doing a lot of pastoral counseling, mm-hmm. It would seem like what would happen in these scenarios is that the woman, the wife, would be the one who always wanted to initiate counseling.
Right.
And the guy would not. Mm-hmm. He was just more stubborn, more resistant. Mm-hmm. And it basically often came to the point where it was an ultimatum. Maybe she had even already left. And then the guy got real willing.
Right.
Then the guy's willing to climb the highest mountain and,
right.
you know, swim the deepest ocean and all that stuff, whatever it takes to make the marriage work. But a lot of times by the time the guy came to that point, the woman was past the point of even wanting to, you know, she had, I don't know if it was
right.
the contempt, resentment, the hurt, disappointment, whatever. And then it was very difficult that late in the process because she had yes. gotten past the point of even wanting to make it work. Do you see a lot of that?
Yes, that's not an uncommon pattern, unfortunately. And wives are still probably more likely than husbands to initiate counseling, although that's beginning to change a little bit. But I still think that as a general rule, that's true. And we do know that when wives begin to disconnect emotionally in a relationship, when they start to essentially give up hope, then that's a really bad sign because the wives will typically hang in there to the last second. I mean, they'll do everything they can to keep hope alive. And when they start to give up, it's really hard for them to turn around and disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time the wife ends up doing something drastic like leaving the marriage and the husband now he's finally ready to, like you say, climb the highest mountain to get mm-hmm. her back, many times it is too late because mm-hmm. she's emotionally disconnected and for her to reconnect is a very challenging process.
Mm-hmm.
And many times it just really is too late.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the research, let me comment on one other thing that kind of relates to all of this that I think has relevance. In starting out some of the research that I've referred to earlier, researchers were trying to answer a very basic question, essentially. And the question was simply, why do some couples make it and some couples don't make it?
Mm-hmm.
We know that we have basically a 50% divorce rate, you know, give or take, whatever. So in looking at these couples and studying just hundreds of thousands of couples, trying to figure out why do some make it and some not, it kind of boiled down to one basic thing. And that is that the couples who make it, who end up with satisfying, stable relationships, are the couples who are able to repair things in their relationships. So this idea of repair, which suggests that for every couple, things fall apart from time to time. You know, the four horsemen show up, or several of them anyway. You know, we have our moments when we don't handle our differences very well. We're insensitive to each other and, you know, do or say things that, you know, are hurtful. But couples who ultimately make it are able to repair it. Now, what's interesting about that is that even the couples who don't make it still try to repair it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that their repair attempts aren't effective.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, this led to other, you know, inquisitive research about, well, why? You know, why is it that some couples have repair attempts that seem to work, whereas other couples, their repair attempts don't work?
Mm-hmm.
So all sorts of variables were checked out on that. You know, is it the way they communicate? Is, you know, is it the timing of things and so forth? And what all of this boiled down to was one thing that seemed to be the critical variable, and that is that the couples who were able to repair things in their relationship were couples who were better friends. It was the friendship quality, you know, the friendship aspect of the marriage that was the critical variable. So, of course, that led to other research about what constitutes a good friendship in marriage and so forth. And we've learned some things about that. But this idea of repair, which suggests that for all of us, even those of us who have really good marriages, good relationships, there are still those moments where things, you know, fall apart. And we have to work on repairing and sometimes forgiving and reconciling and so forth. But for couples who have strong friendships, who've been nurturing that connection, who haven't allowed that wall, so to speak, to come up between them, but they've been able to maintain meaningful connections in their relationship, then their ability to repair things is so much more effective.
I think some people enter into marriage with a very unrealistic expectation. And some people maintain what are probably very unrealistic expectations, you know, long into marriage. And just the idea that my spouse is always going to be perfect. My spouse is always going to be the epitome of my standards, my values, my expectations. One verse that I use a lot in, if I'm addressing this subject, is 1 Corinthians 7:28. And I've used this in a lot of marriage teaching, and it basically says, those who marry shall have trouble in the flesh. And that is one of those, it is actually a Bible statement about marriage, and it seems that there are some Bible promises that people have to really believe and stand and persevere for. 1 Corinthians 7:28, those that marry shall have trouble in the flesh. That's one of those Bible promises that work whether you even believe it or not.
That's right.
It just seems to be the natural consequence of two imperfect people coming in with their different sets of ideas and thoughts and opinions and preferences and priorities and that type of thing. And it's great when we blend and when we are unified, but, you know, we don't marry a clone of ourselves.
That's right.
We are different, and we have to, as you're saying, manage these differences. Do you feel that the expectation issue is a real prevalent issue?
It is. We all have expectations. We're not always aware of what our expectations are, I don't think. Those couples who are involved in premarital counseling or education and so forth, I mean, typically they'll address that to some extent, you know, their expectations about marriage. But even those who have attempted to do their best to address their expectations of marriage still discover that there were expectations they weren't even aware they had. You know, we don't always realize we have expectations until our current experience isn't matching our expectation. There's this discrepancy. And so at that point we realize, oh, okay, we've got a problem here, a difference. And of course, as we mentioned, our first instinct isn't to change our expectation, it's to change our experience, which usually means we're trying to change our circumstances or another person and so forth. Again, things we can't really control. So I think being able to talk about expectations and when they do show up, to be able to have a conversation around them is critical for, for couples. And to realize that expectations don't have to be sacred and set in stone and so forth. I mean, there are typically things that may be important to us, but nevertheless, things that we can learn to make adjustments on at times. Mm-hmm. We can learn to negotiate and so forth. And it's, and sometimes we realize that our expectations really were based on pretty unrealistic ideas anyway. Mm-hmm. And sometimes some expectations just need to be released, and we need to be able to kind of face and accept the reality, which, as you said, according to the scriptures, we'll have trouble mm-hmm. in the flesh. I mean, it's like the opening line of Scott Peck's classic book, The Road Less Traveled. You know, life is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the reality. But that's okay. I mean, it's this part of the challenges of life that are designed to grow us up.
Mm-hmm. And we don't mean to be what's the term I'm looking for? We don't want to rain on a parade. We're not trying to blow out somebody's birthday candles. We're not trying to be negative, pessimistic, fatalistic. But we do, I think couples do better if they're realistic.
Yes.
And I remember I heard Dr. Dobson say something once, and when I heard him say it, I recoiled and thought, that's not right. And he said to the effect, he said, don't make it your goal. Don't strive to have an excellent marriage. And I immediately, because I've been trained, you know, we want excellence in all things, and I believe there's a lot to be said for quality. You know, I'd rather have something good than bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I recoiled at that, and I thought, no, we must have excellence. And but he went on to clarify, and he said, don't strive to have an excellent marriage. He said, strive to have a good marriage. Mm-hmm. And he went on to say that when people say that they're going to have an excellent marriage, many times what they really mean, realizing or not, what they're saying is, I want my spouse to be perfect.
Yeah.
And he said, you end up disappointed, and you end up not being able to enjoy the quality of what you have because you're in such pursuit of perfection that you're never content, you're never satisfied, and you're always, you know, looking at the person through eyes of disappointment and things of that nature. So some of the key things, Bill, I've heard you say today, one thing is the importance of addressing things early.
Yes.
Don't let things build up. Don't let things accumulate. Don't let infection fester.
Right.
And if a couple can work it out on their own, great. Mm-hmm. If a couple can pray together and strategize together, curiosity, ask questions mm-hmm. together, great. At what point do they need to bring in an outside help?
Yeah, that's an important question. And I think it really has to do with a couple of things. I mean, one is that if they really seem like they're struggling to be successful themselves. So it's the couple who really realizes that we keep repeating the same patterns, that in spite of our best efforts, it seems like we're constantly having that here-we-go-again feeling.
Impasse.
Yeah. So we're at the impasse, the gridlock, we feel trapped, stuck, whatever. I think those are signs that couples need to pay attention to and realize that we need to reach out and get help. And the good news is there is help available. We really have learned a lot that I think is very helpful to couples these days. And then sometimes couples just by virtue of caring for their relationship will want to reach out in more of a proactive, preventative way.
Mm-hmm. It's like a health checkup.
Right. Yes. So they may either see a counselor on a regular basis. I have couples that will come by every couple of months just to check in with me. Or they may go to a retreat or a workshop, a seminar, read a book, just whatever the case may be. It's just a way of nurturing their relationship and staying proactive with it.
Mm-hmm. I'll say one thing because I know we have a lot of pastors in our listening audience. I remember one time, and I always considered myself to be a pretty sensitive pastor and a good listener and felt like I had some good insights to share, but I also knew that I was not a trained counselor. I was a pastor, and there is a big difference.
Sure.
And counseling is a set of specialized skills. And so as a pastor, I would try to help people. And I remember one couple in particular that I just felt very frustrated because it seemed like this couple really wanted to get over the hump. They really wanted to get over the things that were creating all the unhappiness in their marriage. And I was telling them all the things I knew to tell them, and I was frustrated, and I knew they were. And I finally just said, guys, listen, I love you enough to tell you that I've gone as far as I can go. And I said, let me please encourage you to go see a counselor friend of mine. and he's skilled beyond my level. He's got years and years of training that I don't have. I said, you know, I can share with you some general Bible concepts to help you, but, you know, this individual to me was just way more qualified. And he was a solid Christian, going to bring, you know, not only the professional expertise, but the same biblical values that I would cherish. And they went and saw this counselor 3, 4, 5 times, I don't know how many. Remarkable turnaround, amazing turnaround. And I know that no counselor claims absolute perfection. I mean, there's a lot of variables involved. Right. But that was such a reminder to me of my limitations. And I just trust that as pastors listen to this, that I think one of the best things pastors can do is have a network for referrals. Yes. And build these, use the term proactive a moment ago as far as what couples do in some of their maintenance of their marriage. Mm-hmm. But pastors build relationships with these people proactively so that when certain crises, certain problems arise in your church, hopefully you'll already have people that you have relationships with that you can work with on a referral basis. You have any mm-hmm. thoughts on that?
I would totally agree with that. I think pastors play a vital role in this process, but I think a wise pastor is one who doesn't try to do too much counseling.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Maybe see a couple for a time or two and then refer them on. And I think, as you mentioned, it's helpful if they have relationships with other professionals in the area that they can refer to and feel comfortable doing so. Because parishioners will often seek out the pastor first. Mm-hmm. And many times it really helps if they have the pastor's permission, so to speak, mm-hmm. to see a professional. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in our tradition and Pentecostal charismatic Christianity, some still struggle with a little bit of a stigma mm-hmm. about seeking counseling or professional help outside the church.
Right.
And when their pastor refers them, when he or she gives them permission, then, you know, for them to go to a therapist is a green light, and it really mm-hmm. makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think pastors can be helpful in a couple other ways, too. We know that prevention, what's the old cliche, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Prevention is such a key factor. Here in the state of Oklahoma, where I reside, we discovered some years ago that we were the number 2 state in the nation in divorce rate.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually the city of Tulsa, where I live, was like, in one list, we were the number 6 city mm-hmm. in the country, right mm-hmm. behind, you know, Las Vegas, Reno, and here's Tulsa.
Wow.
So here we are, the belt buckle of the Bible Belt, leading the nation in divorce rate. And so our governor at the time was concerned about that and set in motion what became known as the Oklahoma Marriage Initiative. And part of that involved working with clergy in the area to get them to voluntarily cooperate with him in some key ways, one of which was based upon the idea that couples still typically want to get married by a clergy person in a church. So most couples will approach a local church, even if they're not necessarily members or attendees of that church, but still want to be married there by that pastor. So it gives the pastor some leverage here.
Mm-hmm.
And so asking pastors to require that before they would marry a couple, that they would require that that couple receive premarital counseling
mm-hmm.
and maybe even wait a certain time period, you know, 4 to 6 months, let's say, so they don't just rush into things.
Mm-hmm. So you should wait before buying a gun and getting married.
Absolutely.
Both can be dangerous.
And doing the premarital counseling, the pastor doesn't necessarily have to do it, you know, himself mm-hmm. or herself, but just seeing that it gets done so the client or the couple can bring to the pastor some kind of evidence that they've gone through some kind of premarital education. Just for that prevention piece. And we've known, too, a lot about that in terms of even the time period as to when it best occurs. It needs to occur probably, you know, 6 months at least prior to the wedding. Mm-hmm. The closer to the wedding that it occurs, the less effective it tends to be mm-hmm. and so forth. But nevertheless, that they get some help of any kind, I think, is important. So the prevention piece before the wedding, and then even more important, we've discovered, is after the wedding. Like 6 months after the wedding is another great time to have a preventative mm-hmm. kind of workshop or checkup with couples, and especially around the birth of the first child.
Mm-hmm.
We've noted that one in particular is a really critical area. that marital satisfaction, especially for wives, often takes a nosedive around the birth of the first child. So here you have this wonderful event that you look forward to and you're excited about, but most couples are very unprepared for how that's going to impact them and change their lives. Mm-hmm. So knowing this, I think the church can do can offer some great services to families mm-hmm. by offering workshops, seminars, classes, and so forth on these various issues that mm-hmm. will help couples prepare not just for marriage but prepare for being parents and mm-hmm. and just to prepare on through the marriage for the various challenges of you know, married and family mm-hmm. life.
And pastors, if you don't feel qualified to do some of that, find a great Christian counselor in your area. Have him come in and do a workshop.
Yes.
I think very often the counselors are in the business of counseling people, and that's beneficial exposure to them and can provide a very valuable service to your people. And I'll just say this too, Bill, I heard years ago that when pastors did in-depth marriage counseling, where especially a lot of ugly things come out and mm-hmm. hurtful things come out in the counseling sessions. And even if there's resolution, even if there's healing of those things, that there's a really high percentage of couples who receive marriage counseling from their pastor. And I'm talking about the in-depth counseling mm-hmm. that will leave the church afterwards.
That's right.
Because they know the pastor knows all those, you know, dark secrets in their life, and they want to go somewhere where the guy they're looking at on Sunday morning doesn't know all that bad stuff. We can all sit here and say, well, they shouldn't feel that way, but hey, if that's how people leave or mm-hmm. feel, then that's how they feel.
That's right. And we've noted that they become especially sensitive to anything that's said from the pulpit in two particular ways. One is they're constantly concerned that maybe the pastor's preaching at them. Mm-hmm. So anything he says that remotely comes close to their own issues, they think, oh, he's preaching at us. You know, he's mm-hmm. picking on us. Or they become very sensitive to him revealing confidences. So if he says anything that remotely comes close to their own issues, he thinks, oh, he's telling on us, or he's revealing mm-hmm. something that we've shared with him, even though he may not be, yet they just become sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. And for those reasons, often feel just uncomfortable mm-hmm. in the church, and we'll look elsewhere.
Yeah, so you can do yourselves a great favor, pastors, by having these strong, solid referral networks and using them appropriately. We're really out of time, but Bill, you've done a great job, and you shared some great things. I think some really eye-opening insights, and I appreciate you doing that. We do want to throw out the disclaimer. And the disclaimer is that this information was all intended to be general in nature.
Right.
It is not psychotherapy or counseling or anything like that.
That's
so
right.
Don't let this information take the place of seeking professional help on an individual basis if that is appropriate. Anything you want to add to that? Or overall, just closing thoughts.
No, I really appreciate this opportunity to share. I really thank you for it. I think this is such a critical area, and I hope that that many pastors will find something useful from what we've talked about today that they can apply in their own context of ministry. Mm-hmm.
And it's stuff we can all apply in
personally,
the context of our own
that's
lives.
Right.
Because pastors, they're not exempt. I mean, we're just human
no,
beings.
That's right.
And sometimes pastors face more pressure in their marriage, not less.
Yes, that's very true.
Bill, thanks for everything you shared. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.